Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn, and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. The Canadian Federation of University Women in Belleville is hosting a community event on Saturday, April 27th with Sally Armstrong. She is an internationally renowned Canadian journalist, author, documentary filmmaker, and human rights activist. She is often referred to as the war correspondent for the world's women. Armstrong has reported for CBC, CTV, Globe and Mail, New York Times, from places like Bosnia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Jordan, and Israel. In this interview, she is outspoken, insightful, and at times shocking. You decide if her story is inspirational. I am absolutely delighted to have with me today Sally Armstrong. Welcome to Consider This Northumberland.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's start off with something really basic. Who is Sally Armstrong?
Well, I'm a journalist. I'm a lot of other things. I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother, a citizen, but I'm a journalist. And I cover zones of conflict, and my beat is to find out what happens to women and girls in zones of conflict, places like Afghanistan, Iraq, South Sudan, wherever there's trouble that involves women.
Where have you worked as a journalist covering these things?
Well, all of those places and many, many more. I don't cover every single conflict that comes along. I cover the ones that have an impact on women in particular, like Afghanistan, which I've been covering since the trouble in Afghanistan started in September 1996. I didn't get in there until March 97, but I've been going back and forth ever since. And similarly, in places even like Somalia and throughout the Middle East and even in Guatemala, if the conflict is involving women, as women, then that's my story.
Who are some of the people who have published your work or aired your work?
Well, CBC, CTV, the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, the New York Times, many magazines. I started in the magazine business, so Maclean's, Chatelaine, Homemakers back in the day. Those are the kinds of outlets I've worked for.
How is it that you became so interested in becoming, as it says in the press release, the war correspondent for the world's women? How did you become interested in that?
Don't you love that remark? It was Michelle Landsberg who coined that phrase, and I think I'm grateful to her forever. How did it happen? I'll tell you, it's a little bit of a long story, but I had become the editor-in-chief of Homemakers magazine, which was always known as the Thinking Woman's magazine. It had already taken on the issues of the day for women. But I needed to find a way to separate my magazine from the other so-called women's magazines. And at that time, Rob, the all news networks had come into our living rooms, and we were getting much more reporting from around the world, but it was invariably reporting about what was happening to men. You would get a 90-second truncated news version of a war or an insurrection going on. It was always about men. And I wondered, what the heck is happening to the women in all these places? And I talked to my publisher and I said, you know, perhaps we should find out. We are the magazine that's supposedly speaking out for women's issues. Now, Rob, at that time, it was unheard of that you would be sending your editor-in-chief over to a zone of conflict. But that's how it began. And it was a very successful venture. The readers came in droves to the magazine.
How did you prepare to go into a war zone?
Well, you weren't prepared, but yes, I feel I prepared myself. And it's the same way that you would do it. You would get all the data you possibly could prior to leaving. You try to find yourself some contacts, a photographer, for example. I mean, I didn't have fixers. I would look for an out-of-work photographer who had a car and could speak English, and that would be my fixer, photographer, and translator. But you need contacts. And once you have those contacts, you can move from there. And I think as a journalist like yourself, your own curiosity leads you to the next place. And then, you know, I have to say that after many years of doing this, I developed a bit of a reputation for as being that sort of journalist. And now when I go into a place, the women step up and say, by the way, you ought to go to this village or you ought to attend that event. And they help me.
What was it like trying to talk to women in those early days? I mean, as you said earlier, men sort of dominated the narrative.
Well, I'll tell you one of the most important stories. Well, they're all important stories, but one of the stories that certainly had a huge effect on me was I had been to Croatia, Bosnia, Kosovo, covering what was happening to children during this war. And it was while I was there, I'm trying to remember, I think it was January 92, I think. And I had my story. I was ready to leave when I began to hear rumors about rape camps. And you know, well, you know very well, one of the first casualties of war is usually the truth. And I thought, this can't be true. They're rounding up the women of the so-called enemy and putting them in camps and gang raping them. I mean, this was before Darfur. It was before Rwanda. It was before we'd heard of these kinds of things, although it's true, they did happen in the Second World War. But at first I thought, this cannot be. But as the day went on, I heard it from more and more credible sources. But I was leaving, and I also worked for a magazine, and I could race this story to press in about 3 months' time. So I gathered everything I could. By the end of the day, I knew something was happening, and I knew I was leaving, and I knew it was not a magazine story. It was a national, international headline. I gathered everything I could, names, anecdotes, even a psychiatrist's name, everything I could gather. And I came home, and Rob, I handed my package of data over to a large news agency, and I said, this is a hell of a story. Give it to one of your reporters. And the person I handed it to said, thank you. And we chatted and I left and I waited and I waited and waited and waited and waited. And 7 weeks later, I saw a 4-line blurb in Newsweek magazine that said they're gang raping women in the Balkans. So I called the man that I'd given it to, the editor. I said, what happened? What did you do with the data I gave you? He said, oh, Sally, said it was a good story and I was going to assign it. But you know, I got busy and you know, I was on deadline and you know, I forgot. I said, 20,000 women were gang raped, some of them 8 years old, some of them 80 years old, and you forgot? And he said, oh, Sally, you're always going on and on about the women. So I told my editorial staff that story and they said, why don't we do it? I said, because I told you I would have done it, but we're 3 months to production in the magazine business. And these great young women editors who worked for me said, don't you get it? Nobody wants it. It's only about women. I was on a plane the next day. And how do I get people to talk to me? First of all, you don't want to ask a rape victim to retell her story unless you have support for her right beside you. And I had that. I had a psychiatrist. But he introduced me to a woman who said, and I will never forget as long as I live, she said, until you say my name and show my face, we will have no justice for what was done to us. And she told me her story. Her name is Eva Penovich. And Rob, I'm almost ashamed to say I won so many awards for that story. And I believe it altered the style of reporting on issues for women. And that's how it really picked up for me. I thought, if no one else is going to tell these stories, I'm going to tell them. Because as Eva Penovich said, until we tell them, we don't get justice.
You've reported from various places all over the world: Somalia, South Sudan, Jordan, Israel, Afghanistan, Iraq, Rwanda, Somalia. Is there anything that is common about your experience in going into these areas and telling these stories? Do you see threads that weave their way through over these periods of times in these various locations?
Well, I'm both pleased and worried that you asked me that question, because it's been on my mind a very great deal in the last 24 hours, and I'll tell you why. The work I do, the threads are there. They're obvious. They're creating a tapestry that the world needs to begin to deal with. You treat your women badly, certain things are going to happen. First of all, your economy is going to go into the ditch. And secondly, the health status of the people in your country is going to be poor to terrible. We don't need to do any more studies to prove that. It's been proven over and over and over again. Why people don't get themselves together and say, I want a successful country. I want my economy to soar. I want the people in this place to be healthy so they'll reelect me. But they don't. In places that have decided that women cannot be part of the human rights and the justice of the country, those countries fail time and again. So that's number one. Those threads have been obvious to me from the very first story that I did. But now there's a new set of threads. And it's because, as you and I know, there's trouble all around us. It's like there's fires burning out of control in Europe and Asia, very close to home. There are elections going on that are very worrisome about who is going to pick up the torch of democracy. And it occurs to me now, these threads, they have an awful lot in common with greedy men who want power. I don't know of people in one country that I've covered who hate the people in another country. For example, I don't believe the Iranians give a damn about the Israelis, and I don't believe the Israelis know a thing about, or not very much, about the Iranians. I think this has to do with greedy leaders who seek power. And we're seeing it more and more today. And I'm sad to say that although my tapestry is the women, this thread is becoming more and more obvious to me, that the troubles in the world today have more to do with greedy men seeking power than anything else. And it's a small number.
I can't imagine some of the stories that you've heard, some of the horrors that you've had to report on. How do these stories, how does this reporting impact you beyond professional? Does it resonate within you, and how does it resonate within you?
Well, of course it resonates. Of course it does. These women's stories, they play on the back of my eyelids when I come home. But you know, there's another side to this. First of all, I get to publish their story. And this is another thing I feel pretty strongly about. We live in a country of people who will stand up to injustice. And I have proof over and over and over again. I write a story about what's going on in a place, and the next thing I know, groups are rising up across the country, or they're writing to the government, or they're demanding change, or they're bringing the women over here. I think it's in a Canadian's DNA to stand up to injustice. I really do. Look at when we bring in refugees, for God's sakes. We furnish apartments and clothe everyone and find parkas, and not those cheap parkas that'll keep you cold. We do that. And then we send them to our schools, where our teachers, so help me, give these kids wings and teach them to fly. I know there's trouble with it, and I'm the first one to criticize IRCC for not doing a proper job. But basically, as Canadians, they stand up to injustice. So the flip side of the scarring stories that I see is that I see action on the other side. And I can tell you another piece of it. In the beginning, you got to go to a place probably once. But now, and pretty soon after that, really, I could go back to a place. I could convince an editor, let's find out whatever became of those people. Remember this one and that one. And now this is more common in reporting. And I do go back. And also with the internet, I stay in touch with people and I can find out how they're getting along. Not always happily, not always successfully, but it's not the same as you used to just file a story and leave it there. In fact, I'll tell you, I was giving a speech in Ottawa, I think it was last year. It might've been the year before, but maybe it was a year and a half ago. And it was to a lot of ambassadors and people who work for the United Nations. And the ambassador to Croatia stood up and she told a wonderful story about having been in a village in Croatia, a very small village. And the people asked her as a Canadian if she knew me. They used my name. And she told that story. And I was thrilled that the people still remembered me. But then she said, "So how is Eva Penovich?" It was her village she was in. And Rob, Eva had died of COVID. It's such a sad thing. And but that came up in the middle of, I was a guest speaker at this ball they were having.
One of the monikers that gets used in describing you is activist. How are you an activist?
Well, I am an activist, and I guess that's because I speak up. If I think something is not correct or fair or just, I will ask questions about that. Again, as I mentioned, I've wrecked a few dinner parties in my day. But I think many people wish to be activists. I think they're afraid that someone's going to label them as mouthy or out of control or controlling. But I think many people question the same sorts of things. What are we doing with war? What the heck are we doing? We go in and we flatten a place. We absolutely flatten it. And then when it's over, we raise billions of dollars to go in and rebuild the place. Do we learn nothing ever? So I think many people agree that you should speak up in the face of I'll give you an example. I'm presently settling an Afghan family. I've settled many. This family, they're just so terrific. But there's such a fabulous example of when you see Canada for the first time. They can't believe everyone stands in line. I drive back and forth to their place. I used to have to pick them up at the airport until I settled them in an apartment. On the road, they said everyone stays between the lines. And then the day I was teaching them how to work the subway system in Toronto, I got confused about one of the stops. And I stopped a police officer and said, "What am I supposed to do here?" Guy couldn't believe it. He said, "I would never, ever speak to a police officer." And it's kind of a pleasure to see. We have loads of problems in our country, don't we? We have loads. And I'm sure we have police officers that need to be replaced, as we have others in other professions that need to be replaced. But by and large, this is a heck of a good place. And I see it reflected in these people. Their little boy is now in a school in Toronto, and he's just flying. Good things are happening, but bad things happen too. I think this is a pretty good place.
You've written a number of best-selling books, but your latest is called Outspoken, My Fight for Freedom and Human Rights in Afghanistan. What made you decide to write this book?
Well, actually, this is a co-authorship. So this is the story of Dr. Seema Samar. And I've known Seema a very, very long time. And I said to her when the government collapsed in August of 2021, I said, "You know, Seema, you ought to tell your story. You ought to tell the full-on story of what it's like to grow up as a woman in Afghanistan, what you have to fight for, what happens to you along the way." But on top of that, I mean, she became the director of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission. She was the very first Minister of Women's Affairs. She was the Deputy Prime Minister. I said, "You know what happened to your country. You know why it collapsed. And it's about time someone told the truth." So she said, "Will you help me?" I said, "Sure, I will." So we're co-authors of this book, but it's her story. And Rob, I think it's I think it's really important that someone finally say what happened. And some pretty ghastly things happened in that country. And they're all in the book. You know, I'll tell you this. I wonder if I should. I'm going to anyway. We had heard why the Americans sold out to the Taliban. Seema knew. I knew. But you know, I said to Seema, every word in this book has to be accurate. If there's one thing wrong, they're going to come after you. We have to be absolutely able to prove everything. So there are some pretty strong accusations about who sold out to who at the end. I really shouldn't tell this. Oh, I'm going to tell. Anyway, I wrote to the U.S. State Department and said, could I please have a report on what happened? And they gave it to me. The whole thing, the whole sellout. So at least we have proof. But you know what? Frankly, I wouldn't have handed that report out. But that's the fine thing about being in a democracy. You're supposed to give the people the reports. Anyway, so we did the book. It took us 2 years to put this book together. And imagine her agony. Can you imagine? She was everything. She's the one who brought human rights to Afghanistan. She brought women's rights to Afghanistan. I have stories about her. I'm trying to think of a short one to tell. I'll tell you a quick one. So when the Taliban were first in charge, it's starting in 1996, and they were in charge until 9/11 happened. And the girls couldn't go to school. The women couldn't go to work. All those hideous draconian edicts. You couldn't leave your house unless you're in company of a husband, brother, son, blah, blah, blah. So Seema is running schools. She's a doctor. She's running schools, but she's running hospitals too. And she's dealing with women's illnesses and kids in school. And the Taliban come up to her on the street and say, shut it down or we'll kill you. Just like that. She didn't skip a beat. She turned right around. She said, go ahead and hang me in the public square and tell the people my crime. I was giving paper and pencil to the girls. So she's full of stories like that, even though she is constantly under terrible threat. But I said to her, we need to include these stories. You know, readers can't just read one piece of ghastly news after the other. Readers need to know what it's like to live there. And people who live there also have their moments, you know, they have family moments. And so I wanted her to be sure to give me the stories that would allow a reader to look at that book and say, this is what it was like. Yeah, I hope it's good.
If there are people listening in today that want to come and hear you at this event in Belleville, what will they hear?
Well, I tell you, Rob, there's something on my mind lately that I have been speaking about that I think is becoming increasingly valid as we examine the trouble we're in around the world. And it's something I call personal will. You know, you and I, everybody, we used to depend on public will and political will to change up the agenda. And it worked. You know, we'd march or sign petitions or raise the roof, and we'd push that politician to sign the paper for what? For a new stop sign, for a shelter, change the law. And it worked. But I saw something happening some years ago, and I've begun to follow this in my work. Malala Yousafzai would be an example. She wanted to go to school to learn to read and write so she could think for herself. That's the bottom line in her story. But there was no march of the people in the Swat Valley saying the girls must go to school. And there was no politician saying, get those girls to school. Malala defied them, and she went to school. The Taliban said, you go to school, we're going to kill you. And she defied them. And they did try to kill her. They shot her in the head, for God's sakes, a 15-year-old girl. And they claiming they were acting in the name of God. Take that one away. But she recovered, thank God. She came back. And she began a movement that is went all over the world, but Girls in Education, you know her, I know her, my grandchildren know her, everybody knows Malala. And I began to see this happening in the places I was reporting from. Seema Samar would be a Malala. Greta Thunberg is another one. And it's people I've discovered that are standing up and saying, what you're doing is not okay with me. And I think this is the bus that's driving change today. I really do. And I'm going to talk about that. And I have a lot of examples. I'll give you one. Maybe I shouldn't. Well, I will. Do we have time or are we getting out of time? You remember, because it's just happened again in Nigeria, remember those thugs, Boko Haram? Remember when they kidnapped 270 girls from Chibok? I was assigned that story. And they put those girls on trucks as standing up so they could get more and more girls into the truck. And as you remember from the news, some of them escaped by jumping off the back of the truck. I wanted to talk to a girl. She jumped off the back of the truck. She rolled herself into the bush. She tried to cover herself up with debris so these monsters wouldn't find her. But they saw her jump and they stopped the convoy. And they went in the bush with great poles stabbing them into the ground to try to find the girl. And thankfully, they didn't. And she got away. But my question to her was, where the heck did you get the nerve to jump off the back of a fast-moving truck? You know what? She answered right away. She said, I figured you can only die once. If I stayed on the truck, I'd die, so I jumped. This is a pretty dramatic form of personal will, but this is personal will. This is someone saying, I'm taking my responsibility for me, and I don't approve of what you're doing, and I'm doing something about it. Now, I certainly would not advise young girls to jump off the back of a fast-moving truck, but I started to see these examples all over the world. And I believe strongly that they're the change makers.
Sally Armstrong, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today.
Well, it was an absolute pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
That was journalist and author Sally Armstrong. She will be speaking at the Marantha Church in Belleville on Saturday, April 27th from 2 to 4 p.m. You can get more information by Googling Canadian Federation of University Women in Belleville. I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.